This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off. All right, everybody. For those of you who are hearing this voice for the first time and you're like, hey, what's going on here, man? What happened to the current host or the old host? Well, go listen to the last two episodes. I am the new host of the Western Rookie Podcast. My name is Dan Johnson. I've been podcasting for over 10 years, and this podcast sits on the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network that I also own. And man, for those of you who maybe don't know me, I've had a podcast called the Nine Finger Chronicles, which kind of focuses on all different shapes and sizes of hunting experiences, storytelling, gear, all that stuff. And I've been doing it for a long time, 10 years now, podcasting for 10 years. And I am, in fact, a Western rookie. I am a guy who has gone out for a handful of years. I live in Iowa. I try to get west every year. I've only been successful a handful of times in those journeys, and I feel like I am a perfect candidate for this podcast because I am still trying to navigate and learn the West as far as tags, as far as land and access, as far as species, what my goals and aspirations are versus what reality actually is in a lot of those circumstances. And I was trying to think of who I wanted to have on as the first guest of me taking this podcast over, and really one name came to mind, and that's my buddy Adam Parr. I'm just going to set it up for you, Adam, real quick. Adam is from Michigan. He's from Michigan. And how many years have you been in Colorado now?
I've been in Colorado a decade. I can't believe
years.
It. 10 years in this last month, June. So yeah. Kind of wild.
Yeah. And you had a very interesting podcast called Transition Wild several years ago that you did for a handful of years. And that was also on the network. And I think you can still find it. I'm pretty sure it's still on the network and you can still find it. But it was kind of the same thing. It was having this conversation about what it's like to go from the East to the West and how you make those changes in order to be successful for a different variety of species. So welcome to the podcast, my friend. It's been a while.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back. Yeah. It feels like I'm kind of somewhat back in the saddle again.
I know,
it'll be fun to talk about this stuff. It's been a while.
Yeah. And I don't know, by the end of this, I'm going to try to talk you into starting up that podcast again. I know you're a busy dude, but I just keep every year.
It was like a sales tactic. Right? I know you, Dan. You're sneaky.
I know. But
Michigan, right? White-tailed deer and turkeys. That's pretty much it. How many years before you moved to Colorado did you actually come out west to hunt?
I never did. You know, I always had aspirations to do it and always just kind of thought, you know, I'll get to it someday, but I never really kind of ever put that in place. I mean, I moved out when I was 25. You know, so it wasn't like I was like deep into a career and had a bunch of money laying around. I was just trying to, you know, make ends meet, and you know, so it's tough, you know. It does take a commitment and a decent amount of money to, not a ton, we can talk about that later, but you know, I never did it. I always thought I would, but just didn't know when. And so when I made the move, it just, obviously it's my backyard now, so yeah. it's made it a whole lot easier.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
What was one of the driving forces that made you pack up from Michigan and move to Colorado?
I think part of it was just knowing people that lived out there already. Mm-hmm. And I went to visit them, and you take vacations and, you know, never hunted, but it was just always go out to visit friends or, you know, do a vacation or whatnot. So, it was one of those things where it was just, at the time, it's like, hey, let's go and move. We're kind of at a point where I like quit my job, and I was kind of in like a career change, like pivotal kind of time in my life. And at the time, it just made sense to try something new.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd be in Colorado this long, you know, maybe try it out for a few years or 5 years and then maybe move back. But here I am. I love it. And, I definitely see myself being here for a long time.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. And honestly, I look at a story like yours, you know, I had kids, later on in life, and then any aspirations of going and doing something like that now are impossible for me because I have my roots here. I have my kids here and stuff. So take this with it, what I'm about to say, with a grain of salt. I know you will, but it's like, you're young. There's no consequences for any action that you have. If you fail, you can always go back home. Right.
Right.
So no real responsibilities. You pulled the trigger and you're like, dude, I'm going to Colorado, man.
Right. Right. Exactly. I didn't have kids. I had a girlfriend at the time that was, you know, she wanted to move out as well and just kind of take that leap as well from Michigan too. So it just, it was pretty easy. No commitments. It's different now, but but at the time it was cool, and it was something new and exciting, and just to live in Colorado. I always dreamt of that, and like, could see myself living here, but to make it actually happen, it felt kind of surreal and how it all came together. But love it. It's a good time.
Awesome. So hunting, right? You were a deer hunter back in Michigan, and now when you get into Colorado, that opens up a whole bunch of different species, anywhere from whitetails, antelope, mule deer, elk, all of that stuff. So when you moved out here, you finally got here and you were able to start saying, okay, well, I moved, I can hunt. What was the process for you, maybe choosing what species to hunt, because back when you started, it was over the counter everything for the most part, right?
Right.
And now, you know, for elk. Yeah. What was the process for you once you got here, once you became a resident, to actually find the locations to hunt, know the rules and regulations, find a species that you've never hunted before? What'd that look like?
Yeah, so I moved out in June of 2015, like kind of end of June. Mm-hmm. And so actually that fall, I didn't even hunt. I didn't get an elk tag. I didn't hunt that fall because, one, I still wasn't technically a resident. You know, you got to be here 6 months or whatever. And I was just like, I don't feel like spending the money. I don't know what I'm doing yet. I don't have any of the gear. I haven't really, you know, never done it before. So, and I had other tags in other states I wanted to kind of focus on for whitetail, go back to Kansas a bunch. And I might even, no, I didn't have Iowa tag that year. But so I kind of took the year off to like, just prepare, save some money, and then I kind of put that, help me kind of get my gear in order, mm-hmm. right? Like some of the camping gear I needed, you know, because I didn't have any of that growing up in Michigan. I mean, hell, I hardly ever left, you know, a couple hundred acres. I hunted a little bit of state ground, but I mean, you never needed camping gear for Michigan right. hunting on private ground and, you know, cornfields and stuff. So I kind of used it as a time to get out and maybe do some hiking, get some of the gear bought, like boots you pack. And, you know, there's just a lot of stuff. You don't necessarily need it, but it definitely helps depending on what style of hunting you're going to try to go after. So, that was kind of the initial thing. And then by then I think I started the blog. I think that next summer, or maybe that winter right after season or something, I can't remember, but
yeah,
that kind of got my gears spinning of like, man, this really is different. I mean, it's similar in some ways, but I mean, biggest thing for me was like just the vast terrain and getting comfortable with that. And, yeah. you know, like being out without cell service, God forbid, you know, and I learned how to use GPS and navigate by yourself. And it was just so different and intimidating.
Yeah.
Really. So I don't know. I knew I wanted to hunt elk and do all that stuff. But it kind of really just started with getting the gear kind of in order. I kind of already had a place figured out to hunt just around where I live, and also Danny's cabins where you had been hunting before, where we have hunters come in and, you know, rent those out and stuff. But yeah, I guess that was kind of the initial.
So getting the gear in order, just because, you know, your regular muck boots and, right. you know, muck boots and hooded sweatshirts to go to the tree stand just doesn't cut it.
Right, right.
At yeah. alpine level. Right.
Right. Yeah. I remember hiking around in my muck boots that first, like my, you know, mm-hmm. knee high water. I was like, and I think about that now and I'm like, man, that really sucked. Like it wasn't fun. And yeah. you know, so there's just certain things that make sense to spend the gear on, you know, money, you know, to buy that
yeah.
specialty gear more for Western style hunting. So,
yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
And that's coming from a guy who, I mean, based off of the conversations that we've had earlier, was like, you had to do it in a way that was affordable to you. So you couldn't go and just drop a whole bunch of coin on like the best Sitka or the best Kuyu and the, you know, the Kennetrek, the most expensive Kennetreks and things like that. You had to do it in a way that's like, dude, I'm a broke 25-year-old who just moved to Colorado.
Right.
I got to figure out like options here.
Right. Exactly. And I definitely had an advantage more than probably other people for sure. I mean, I worked in the hunting industry and so I got all those gear discounts, but yeah. that's how I wanted to also set up my life. You know, I wanted to be able to make that a big part of who I was and what I was doing is more of a lifestyle at the time, to be immersed in it, I yeah. guess. And then that opened up a lot of doors, especially from the gear side.
Right.
And you know, I know everybody doesn't have that opportunity, but you know, maybe somebody at home, they could get a part-time job at Sportsman's Warehouse or Cabela's and, you know, you could take advantage of some yep. of those deals, start preparing a little bit in that sense. It gives you a little bit more knowledge and you know, at least kind of helps you start building that list. And again, I'm not, you know, you don't need everything. I think a lot of people go way too overboard on right. gear related stuff. And they think it's like the biggest part. Certainly not, but
yeah.
there are a few things that you really do need to spend the money on and do it right
yeah.
the first time.
If you were going to have a conversation with a guy like myself or a younger version of me who is thinking about coming out and doing a Western hunt for the first time on this bigger landscape, what would be the recommendation for, like, if you're going to spend money on one product, what's that product that you should spend money on?
I'd have to say boots yeah. would be the most important thing. I mean, that's really everything in Western hunting, unless you're unless you're Jimmy John getting flown in on a private jet and, you know, taking a side by side out to the Wallow, you know, you don't really need that. But I think for the most of the people listening to this right now, just get some good boots. I mean, you don't have to spend $500, but you know, maybe in that 300 or so range, and you know, gear it towards what type of hunting, you know, maybe late season you need something a little bit insulated. Maybe if it's early bow season, you can get by with, you know, ankle, you know, boots that or really good, like, kind of hiking shoe hybrid boot that would get the job done depending on what time you're hunting. But I would say boots would be the most important thing.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Okay, so you got the gear situated, right? And you said to yourself, okay, I got everything I need to be a little bit more comfortable in this new environment. Like, what steps did you take to find out where the access was? Where, because, you know, Michigan, Iowa, Kansas, you mentioned those states already, like Iowa and Kansas, they're low public land. So you're either knocking on doors or you're trying to find the slivers of public that we have available. Colorado's a little bit different in that there's a lot of public, especially around where you live, within an hour of driving, if not a little bit more. What was the access like of where you were going to hunt, and what did that look like?
Yeah, it was, you know, that was the time where I had Onyx, but it definitely wasn't as good as it is now, you know, right, as far as showing like roads and different things. So I did have that, but it was still really confusing. And still, I mean, you know, you can do all the digital scouting you want and you think you have access to a certain spot, but when you get out here, the road's private or blocked, or it's no longer a road, or it's closed down, you know? So you always have that, like, kind of up against you, especially if you're getting into an area, you know, starting out. But
yeah,
gosh, I remember the first time I went, like my first actual weekend, opening weekend going out, and I thought I had this spot figured out, and there was like a road I had to drive through, and it kind of looked like I was driving through someone's driveway or what, you know. But yeah, I didn't, you know, you don't know, like, you know, there's certain spots, like even where I hunt now, it kind of, like, that's just the way the West works, where you know, you could be driving right through somebody's land. But I thought it was public, and it was public where I was hunting, but you had to kind of access to this road. Well, the outfitter guide that was in that area saw me come through. He already had guys in there hunting lined up, and he threatened to lock me behind the gate so I wouldn't be able to get out. He was like, I'm gonna lock you behind here, and you're gonna have to pay me $150 to get out of here. I'm like, whoa, you know, like, I'm not trying to, like, cause a stir, but yeah. I still don't know to this day if I was in the right or the wrong. I think it was fine. I think he was just trying to strong arm me to keep his, you know, not have, you know, guys coming in on top of his, you know, guided hunt. So that was kind of like a, you know, a sore spot to kind of start off initially. It just was kind of degrading. So kind of had to flip flop my whole plan and, you know, go to a completely different access area, and, you know, it still worked out. But
yeah,
that's a big thing, you know. It's tough to really figure that out until you're actually out there doing it, you know.
And I'll tell you this, even in states, like, I look at a state for me, like North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, the western parts of those states, I almost consider that, like, that's the West. Because for me, I look at a little bit of terrain change, or the change in terrain, western Kansas, western Oklahoma, even Texas is its own animal. But then anything west of those things, that's the West. And so even my experience driving through Wyoming or driving through western South Dakota, you'll look at this map. And this is where, for me, it's been really intimidating, is you'll pull up Onyx. Onyx shows you that there should be there's a road here. It's supposed to be open to the public, but then you have all of these signs that say no trespassing, private road. And so now you're having to take this internal, you have this debate where, who am I supposed to who am I supposed to listen to? Am I supposed to listen to Onyx, or am I supposed to listen to the landowner or whoever's putting these signs up? And then you have to take, if you truly want to do it, you got to get on the phone with somebody to be like, hey, listen, is this road open? Is it private? Are these signs real or whatever? And then that just takes
it. It can be almost impossible to get a hold of somebody.
Exactly. Exactly. So it can be really intimidating trying to figure out what the hell is going on with some of these access points. Even for example, when I was out in South Dakota one year on a big chunk of BLM, and then bordering the BLM was a bunch of walk-in, but the walk-in didn't start. So along the entire fence line, it says no trespassing, but then about 100 yards into the thing, you can see another sign that says walk-in access. So from the road, 100 yards in was no hunting, but then past that, so you had to go in through the BLM to get to the walk-in. And so it became really, really tricky. And it's like all these nuances and things that you have to learn in order to get to that next step of truly navigating and starting your hunt, which can be complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's confusing. And there's some areas where, you know, it might be a gated road, but you could technically still walk that road. You're just not going to be able to like drive through it. You know, it might just be like certain landowner access beyond this point for vehicles only.
Yep.
Right. But then, you know, it's still a county road or still a public roadway. And so you could throw a bike over the fence and, you know, bomb through there or just hoof it. So you're seeing that a lot too, you know, where you'll run into that. Doesn't necessarily mean you can't access through there. You just might not be able to drive a vehicle, you know, all the way to where you think you can. Yeah. But it's intimidating. It's confusing. It was one of the biggest things I struggled with early on, you know, especially if you're trying to hunt some of those, you know, lower ground BLM stuff where you're, you know, dealing with multiple tracts of smaller land and, you know, private bordering and, you know, it's just, but if you get up into more of some of the bigger tracts of national forest and, you know, usually you're pretty good, you know, with that stuff on Forest Service roads. Some of them might be washed out, some might be closed, but you're not going to run into a lot of gates, at least from my experience. But
what other than Onyx and like digital mapping services, what resources did you use to figure out, like, get more black and white answers to whether or not a road or a piece of property was in fact huntable or you did have legal access to it?
I did some calling around, you know, but again, I just remember even back then, I mean, I'm sure it's a nightmare now with just less staffing and everything. Yeah. You know, it's just hard to, I mean, the Parks and Wildlife's not going to really be able to weigh in on that. I mean, it's really talking to the local, you know, BLM office or different things that, but I pretty much only use Onyx. I used Google Earth. That would give you a little bit better picture of like a road condition and sometimes better imagery. You can see if there's a gate or, you know, certain roadblocks, potentially a little bit better terrain elevation. But I really used Google Earth more as like in Colorado. I made a YouTube video when I was doing the YouTube channel. I made a YouTube video on, you know, downloading the KMZ wildlife, you know, data files. Now I think Onyx, I think that's a layer that you can download for Colorado, but it basically showed like species data. You could pick like mule deer, for example, and find where they're rutting, and it would show you kind of like a general range, or elk, you know, like where their summer, you know, summer habitat that is. And, you know, that might translate well into, you know, that early, you know, September, you know, hunting where they're still kind of in their bachelor groups and hangouts for the summer. So I did a lot of that with Google Earth. And that definitely helped on the scouting aspect and some road imagery too.
Yeah, I feel you. Okay, so you get the access now, right? And you're starting to figure out the access and you're figuring out where you can and you cannot go. But now you can get there, but now it's time to hunt, right? So I want to talk about, like, you've killed elk with a gun and bow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is, going into it your first year, from a weapon standpoint, what were you planning? Were you like, dude, I'm gonna kick this off with a rifle hunt, so I can take a longer shot. I don't need to be as good as getting close to them. Or did you jump in with the bow and was like, screw it, I'm going?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a lifelong bow hunter myself. I started hunting with a bow the first season I could in Michigan when I was 12, you know, and just never missed a season. Mm-hmm. And so a bow for me then, and still to this day, I'm way more comfortable taking out a bow than I am a rifle. It's weird. It's like, I don't practice enough with a rifle. I really should do it more, but there's something about, you know, hunting with a bow for me that it just feels so much more comfortable. It feels more natural, and it's just what I love to do. Yeah. A rifle definitely has that advantage of reaching out, but I love everything about archery season. It's just you get better weather,
right?
You know, that's another factor when you're coming from out of state and you're not used to, you know, the mountains. I mean, you get into later September and or, you know, October into those rifle seasons. I mean, you really have to be prepared for snow and deep snow and shitty weather. And that means tire chains and, you know, different sorts of gear that you may need to dig yourself out or get back into certain areas. You know, it's just it's not the same. So I just like, if you're a bow hunter from the East Coast or Midwest or whatever, and that's what you love to do, I think bow hunting is really the way to start. If it's something you already know, it's just, you're taking a lot of less factors out of it. You don't need that cold weather gear. You don't need the, you know, super cold sleeping bags if you're staying out, you know, camping and things like that. It allows you to get by with a lot of the gear you normally have and still have a good hunt. So, I just love archery. You get the bugling and calling and the weather's good and it's, the leaves are changing and, you know, it's just, for me, it's magical. And I hope to never miss a season until I'm 6 feet under.
So. There you go. There you go. Okay. So now you're ready, right? You access, you got the gear, your weapons are ready to go, but now you have to find them in the new environment. And now you got to get close enough to shoot them with a bow or whatever the case may be. What was that first season like for you out here or out there? And walk us through the learning curve of hunting a new species, especially elk.
Right. And I think, you know, if you're someone that's coming out here for the first time, if you can befriend somebody that's done it before, and or, you know, maybe somebody that lives out, just like, you know, your first experience. I mean, you knew me and, you know, I was able to show you the ropes a little bit. I'm a shitty guide and we didn't end up getting it done, but, you know, at least it gets you in the ballpark a little bit quicker. If you have somebody willing to at least share that, but let's say you don't, if you're new and trying to come out, my first season, it was that scenario I was talking about where I kind of got closed off and, you know, thankfully I had some backup plans. You know, so if you're trying to figure out your spots and, you know, may at least have three or four options to get into, but, you know, I knew it would be a good area. I kind of talked with some of the locals and it was a wilderness area. So there wasn't any road access. You couldn't even ride, you know, for a wilderness area in Colorado, you can't even take a wheelbarrow or a non-motorized bike. It's just, or a game cart, you know, it's nothing mechanical. So I chose that because I was like, well, it's probably a better chance. I'm not going to get the road hunters as much, right? Like people drive. I didn't have an ATV. I didn't have a side-by-side. I didn't have the advantage of, you know, pushing back into some of these areas with my full-size truck. You know, so I wanted to kind of eliminate that variable. So I kind of knew it was a good spot, and I'd heard from some of the locals it was. And so I did it and hiked in there, and it was a lot of fun. It was also very intimidating. because I had never done that before. I spent the night. I went in with my tent. I was all alone. You know, like couple miles in, and I was like, wow, I'm doing it. I'm in it. There were so many times on the walk in, I was like, I need to turn around. Like, this is, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm scared. You know, honestly, I'm not afraid to admit that. I was intimidated for sure by myself. But
let me ask you a question there, because I think that's a tipping point for a lot of people is, hey man, I don't know if I can do this type deal.
Right.
Right. And you literally just explained, like, you made it past that point and you actually did it. Like, so what were you concerned about? What were the concerns that were going through your head as you're walking in for the first time going, Jesus, man, I don't know.
Yeah. Just no service, you know, I didn't have cell service, and you know, I'd never been by myself in that scenario. I mean, and then when you're in an environment where there's mountain lions and bears, and I mean, we don't have grizzlies in Colorado. Yeah. I mean, that takes a big factor of safety out of there, but there's always those things in the back of your mind. Like, is my GPS going to work? You know, am I going to hurt myself and not be able to, you know, get out on my own? Mm-hmm. I could fall. I could, you know, I could get attacked by a bear. I don't know, you know. It's just all those things that if you come from Michigan, and I see it all the time with groups that come out and hunt the cabins, like, you know, kind of give them an area, like, yeah, there's all this land here, you know, those elk could be pretty far back and up high, and it's a rugged hike to get into some of those locations. And I was like, you know, talk to them after they're done, like, did you go check out any of those spots? And like, nah, we just, you know, we just didn't do it. Like, just, you know, whether they're out of shape or that, I think a lot of people get intimidated. I mean, you know, that country back there, it's extremely rugged,
very rugged.
It's hard to navigate. Yeah. So it's intimidating for a lot of people. And I think that's the hardest part. That's why I recommend if you can go out with somebody that at least has done it before and knows the game. And then when you're hunting with somebody too, you have that factor of like safety net, right? Like some shit goes down, then at least you have somebody there as well, you know? Yeah. So it was tough to get over that mental hurdle. But once I did it, you know, you got into that scenario, you kind of lock in a little bit more.
Yeah. And I'll tell you this, man, that was literally the hardest thing. Like for me, the gear, like calling you, and I did have a little bit of help on my second elk hunt. Like when I went to Colorado or Idaho with Mark for my first hunt, holy cow, that was brutal because I was not physically where I needed to be for that hunt. And it wasn't extremely high. I mean, it was 2000 feet lower than where we were at. But still, I mean, I probably didn't have the right boots. I had, my equipment was okay, but not necessarily good enough. And then the next thing was what kind of shape I was in. And so knowing that, like, that was a huge anchor. Like when you come from Iowa or, you know, the old Flatlanders, and then you're coming up to like 8,000 feet, you know, 8,000 feet, and then getting out of a truck and then starting a hike immediately after no sleep, probably a little dehydrated. And then you get up there and my ass was beat immediately for the entire week. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Knowing that though, then I come to Colorado the next time with you and Ryan, and I was a little bit more prepared physically, but my favorite was that first hike up that hill right out of the cabins. Every morning, it wasn't massive, but it woke you up and you're less like, holy shit, like we're going another 1,000 feet up right now. You gotta be kidding me.
Right.
Oh my God. And so that is that, as I'm walking up that creek bed or that, you know, that washout or runoff or whatever you call it, all those boulders and stuff, and you're sucking air and your head is throbbing and you're not used to that. You're like, I want to stop right now. So if I was, honestly, if I wasn't with you or Ryan, I probably would have stopped. But when you have a group of people that have the same goal in mind, you can lean on each other a little bit to be like, hey, you coming? Come on, let's go. You good?
Right.
Let's go.
Right.
And you get up there and you made it. And then you get there and then you start to hear some elk bugle. And then you start to go like, okay, well, there's a couple realizations. You're up that high. You finally, you're happy that you're seeing elk sign and you're hearing elk. And then you have to realize like, holy shit, if we do actually shoot one, it's going to be a son of a bitch getting it out of here. And so it's
like, there's just so many things. I think a lot of it too is just, you know, with anything in life, you kind of fear, you have the most anxiety and fear about something prior to actually doing it.
Right.
But once you kind of get in it and you're actually in the act of the hunt or hiking in or whatever, you're like, okay, we're here. We're going to tackle this and we're going to do it, you know, but I'm probably not the best person when I take people out for the first time, I tend to kind of overwork them a little bit push them, maybe, like, you know, like, cause I'm used to it, you know, I'm used to that country. Right. Like, so for me, it's not as big of a factor, but I have to remind myself like, damn, this was me, you know, 10 years ago and how hard that actually was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my first year elk hunting, I'd spent a month straight in Texas, you know, although I'd been living out there for a year, I think I actually acclimated back to sea level because I literally was gone for a month in Texas at sea level. And so I came back and I started that hike in and I was just, it felt like I was back to square one. Honestly, you lose it pretty quick. So,
yeah, I think one of my favorite memories is we made this huge loop on looking for elk and we had this, we came around, it was a son of a bitch getting up there, but it was gradual. And then we got to a point where we started calling and there's another big drainage in front of us that we decided not to go down, but we decided to go down elevation and then go up elevation. And it was this face of deadfall that was like, dude, it was brutal. And then we get to the top of it. I am done. Like I'm physically done. And then you're like, oh, I got to make it to this appointment. I don't know if you remember this or not, but you had to leave to go to an appointment. And I'm like, if you told me I had to be back at the truck in 45 minutes starting now, no way. But you're like, all right, well, I'll see you guys later. And you just took off and you went. Or the time where me and Ryan we're glassing and we see this bow hunter like above the tree line, just hiking way up there. And then it was Danny. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? Like, how are these people physically able to do this? But they're in it all the time.
Right.
And so they're acclimated to it. So I have a rule now. If I'm going to go and hunt elevation, I'm getting there. Like, for example, the last elk hunt I went on, when my dad came, we went there and I was 24 hours before I even stepped foot to go hunt, I was getting acclimated to that. And it did really help as far as elevation is concerned.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Just losing, you know, getting in shape as much as possible. But I think for me, you know, like I've lost almost like 30 pounds since I quit my job a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And like, I think about that, like just from a standpoint of, like, man, I lifted up I had a 25 pound dumbbell, you know, sitting in my closet and I lifted that thing up and I was like, damn, that's actually really heavy.
Yeah.
And like, think about from a standpoint of lugging that extra weight on top of your backpack and the you know, you need to bring some layers and you got your bow and your binoculars and food and water and like that extra 25, 30 pounds on top of all that other gear, like, that makes a big difference.
Oh, hell yeah.
Especially when you're putting on miles at high elevation, you know, 10,000 plus feet, like what we were doing. And so I think that, you know, getting in shape is a big part of it. But if you can drop some of that weight, you know, and prepare, I mean, even if it's 10 pounds, just think about how much better you're going to feel and less, you know, stuff you're actually carrying around. It makes a huge difference. You know?
Yeah. I'll say this, as far as preparing for my hunts, I like my first Idaho hunt, I went to a strictly like squats and like lifting weights, but not a lot of intense heart rate stuff. Just, I'm going to be in shape from a lifting standpoint. I was eating healthy, but I was in nowhere conditioned muscular wise to do that. And then, so when I came out to Colorado, I had bought one of those Atlas trainers and I put a 45 pound plate on that. And I started taking hikes and I started gradually working my way up months in advance, and getting my heart rate up, basically just simulating everything except the high elevation.
Right.
And it helped. It literally helped me. And I dropped and I understood that 10 pounds around the waist is still 10 pounds around the waist. Your legs don't know any different. And so if you can drop 10 pounds, and then for me, whenever I go out west, I'm like, dude, if I can drop 10 pounds, that's like 5 more pounds of gear that I can carry to make whatever I, whenever I'm in the backcountry, more comfortable. Like, I like to take apples with me. That's not an efficient food to pack when you're packing, but it keeps me regular in the wood. Like, you know what I mean? And it also is like,
that's important.
Yeah. Fresh fruit is tastes good when you haven't had it right at the end of a long day. And you're not just eating a protein bar and some dehydrated meals. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think for the typical person too, like, you know, at least it was for me, and those weeks, it's like you come out, you got that adrenaline going. You're just going to fight through it. Everything's exciting. You go really hard the first day or two, and then you're just gassed.
Yep.
And you're super tired. So like day three, you just don't want to get out of bed, you know, and your legs are tired and you're sore and you're just beat down, you know? So, and then by the end, you kind of, if you push through that, you kind of come back and, you know, and get your legs back underneath you. But it's tough to push through that mental bridge too, because I've been there where you push yourself too hard, especially out of the beginning, and you just gas yourself out really quick. It makes it really tough to, you know, some people give up. I mean, I've heard people just like, man, I'm done. Like, I'll leave and go. I've had, you know, friends tell me they've had buddies leave just out of nowhere and like go back home. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, just completely give up, you know, and I get it. You know, it's not easy, but, you know, you also have to think about, man, if you actually do get one, man, that pack out is serious work. I would say I'm not a bodybuilder, Olympic marathon, best shape in the world guy, but I mean, I live out here and I take pretty good care of myself physically. Yeah. But man, I struggle with the pack out. I mean, that's really the cherry on the top. Yep. Is like, you really do have to think about that. And a lot of people don't, you know, they're like, man, there's just no way this, like, it's a very small percentage. It's going to happen, but it can happen. And it does, you know, I mean, it's going to happen. But then a lot of people just aren't prepared.
No.
One, physically, and have the gear and, you know, think about that scenario. Cause if it does and you're not prepared, you're in trouble. It can be pretty tough. For sure.
My first pack out, my first mule deer pack out was insane, where we just wanted to get back to the truck as fast as possible. So we didn't debone our hindquarters. We just we cut off the hooves basically down and then put it in. And so each of us, like, he had the deer head on him, on his back, and probably 100 pounds of meat. And I had 100 pounds of meat, and we both were carrying our archery equipment. By the time we got back to the truck after about 4 miles, I was literally emotional. Like,
Dan's crying in the corner.
Dude, it was crazy. Like, I don't want to say I was crying, but I was like really emotional.
It's okay, Dan. This is a safe space.
A safe space. Okay, perfect. Perfect. But I was like, holy shit, I can't believe I just did that. And my legs the next day were toast. Like, it was unreal. Right. So we had to take an entire day off for the next day to get back and go hunting again. So it was insane. Outside of that, but it was an experience. But now last year, I knew what to prepare for physically. I'm going to start doing that again here pretty soon. And then I was conditioned well enough to where the mule deer I shot this year, granted it was not as big. We deboned all the meat out in the field and I had another guy help me carry it. Right. It was a smaller bodied mule deer, but I was, almost skipping through the terrain out there because I was better prepared for it. And I had a little bit of adrenaline because it was my first ever mule deer that I'd ever killed. So, I was jacked about all that stuff. So anyway, what I'm getting at is the better you are prepared, the better success, the deeper you can go, the further, the easier the pack outs are, if you're conditioned to like 8 hours, and it's hard, right? It's literally hard to be like, okay, well, I have a full-time job. I have a family. I got kids. How do I prepare for 8 hours of hiking? You don't.
Right.
You got to tough it out.
Right. Yeah. And some of the, like, you could pick up on, once you get out here, you'll learn about the animals. I mean, it's just with any hunting, you're going to learn when you're in that environment, what they're doing, where they're bedding, whatnot.
Yeah.
Just coming into it, the best you can be as far as, physical conditioning and shape, it's going to go a long ways. I don't think the gear is important. You can get by with what you have, but just having that physical edge. And then, for me personally, it was just like mentally trying to come to terms with, that bigger landscape and different terrain and being out of cell service. So if you're in that same boat, like I was, like, just, maybe do some camping, hiking trips and a bigger, take a local regional trip or whatever to your area and spend a night or two out just bushwhacking and camping, along the way, and try to simulate that a little bit, get more comfortable with those types of scenarios. You kind of learn a process and things like that. That's the type of things that are going to translate well to, the Western hunter. You'll figure out the other stuff and you'll get out there and you'll do it. But if you can kind of come in with that knowledge, the physical and the mental, that really goes a long ways.
That's a fact. What about learning the species? I mean, cause now I want this to be general because you've hunted Western whitetails, you've hunted elk, you've hunted antelope, right?
I've put in a couple times, but I haven't drawn yet. I've kind of been waiting for a pretty good tag.
Okay. But you've hunted mule deer, elk, So like, what's the strategy from that point going, geez, where do these animals live? How do they move through the terrain? Where are they at different times of year, high, low, like all that stuff kind of plays a role into that first step that you have to take of knowing where to go.
Yeah. That's the hardest part about, I think, elk hunting. That's a big wake up call from just a Midwest whitetail hunter. It's just the hardest part is finding them, and I still struggle with that. It's not easy and it changes year to year. It's depending on drought or conditions or cover, feed or wildfire or whatever pressure. I would say for the most part, I mean, whitetail hunting from all the places I've been and different states and everything, I consistently year to year, if I've hunted the same spots multiple times, like everything seems to be kind of like standard by the book. I can always find whitetails. Mm-hmm. Now killing them is a different story, or killing the buck that you want, age class or whatever is a different, standpoint. For elk, it's kind of the opposite. It's like finding them's the hardest part. Killing them, I felt like it was a lot easier than a whitetail. They're just not as jittery or as wired. They're not on a swivel and not as jumpy all the time. So it's, I don't know. It's just, you kind of have to get in. Cause I did a lot of studying of different maps and things like that. And you can do as much homework and digital scouting as possible, but until you actually get out there and get into it, it's, it can be a bit challenging, you know, like you kind of have to just have backup plans, have different options, different areas. There's certain things that you can do like blind call and bugle, but you know, that's getting tougher and tougher to call and do things like that, just because Colorado specifically is a very pressured state. You know, there's things that are changing with, especially with the archery and everything, non-resident going to a draw, mm-hmm. you know, but man, it's can be very tough, you know, especially if you're just doing it over the counter on public land, national forest, whatever, to actually find those elk. It's not easy.
Yeah. I mean, is there any tips? Like, what did you have to do to find them?
I mean, I feel like I got kind of lucky. I just, initially it was just, putting on the miles, putting yourself in scenarios of trying to get in spots where you could see a lot more glass, things like that. But that also depends on the, you know, terrain and environment. Like where me and you hunted together, there's not a lot of glassing opportunities. So you're strictly just kind of, you know, putting miles on to try to find recent sign, rubs, beds, you know, all that stuff. Try to get in some openings where you could get eyes on them. But, but there's certain scenarios like that, the first area I ever hunted, you know, you could see a little bit more. And I also feel like when I first started, and I say this all the time, and I've told you this before too, there used to be a lot, it seemed like more elk, and also just they weren't as pressured. So I had a easier time finding those animals.
Yeah.
And I think since COVID, especially, you know, getting to 2019 and definitely through, you know, 2024, I feel like we're starting to turn a page now. But man, if you're just strictly going on public land, national forest, that stuff, like, it is hard. I mean, you don't have the opportunities, you know, that you used to. You have to work a lot harder. You have to, you know, stay out a lot longer. You have to hike and cover more miles just to see where those elk are. They were very, very pressured the last 5 years. And I think that's why, you know, Colorado Parks and Wildlife has finally listened to people and to the, you know, the surveys to limit, you know, some of these tags, because it's just, it's a lot of people are getting frustrated with it and have been, you know?
Yeah. So let me ask you this. You say there's less deer on the landscape. And this is a great conversation, because there is a lot of animosity between residents and non-residents, in specific states, and on how tags are allocated. And you know, the residents are like, well, I can't even go hunt anymore because I got all these non-residents you know, in the areas, right? And you brought up that, you know, there's a lot more pressure, there's less elk. Is there less elk because of specifically the pressure, or is there less elk because of natural occurrences like drought or like wildfires or wolves or whatever the case is that are taking their toll on them that are non-hunter related?
Right. Yeah. And maybe I should rephrase, like, I don't necessarily think there's less elk per se. There might be in certain areas, you know, and it varies maybe year to year, winter stuff or whatever. I just think a lot of it has to do with hunting pressure, and you have these huge, you know, ranches that might be 15,000 acres, 10,000, 20,000 that are highly managed. I mean, when you put 50 or 100 guys in a couple square mile area and they're hunting these elk, I mean, where do you think they're going? They're very susceptible to pressure, and they don't like, you know, any human intrusion.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of them are just getting pushed onto these bigger ranches and private lands. And it's just like, that kind of takes them off the table and makes it really tough. So, I think the elk population is doing well. I've definitely seen it come back in the last couple of years, like I said, I'm starting to see a change. And I think a lot of people had stopped coming out like they normally had, just from the fact that they weren't getting the opportunities that they had, you know, 5-10 right. years ago. That's how I experienced it. And that's how I talked to a lot of people. So I think Colorado in the next 2 to 5 years, I could really see it becoming, you know, something worthwhile and worth, you know, taking
playing the preference point game again, right. and all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You could always get a good draw unit, save up, but you know, your general kind of what were over the counter units are now draw for archery hunters. I mean, I have high hopes for, I think this is the right move for sure. And it's going to make everybody have a lot more success. You know, especially with the wolves coming in, you know, there's that other factor, you know, you hear about this, and I've never hunted elk in other states, but you hear about it in Montana or Idaho where there are wolves, you know, like some of those elk can be pretty like call shy, you know, they don't, you're not hearing the bugles a ton and, you know, whatever, just because that can be a dinner bell for the wolves and just showing location. So they're like, there's that factor and then hunting pressure and everything like that.
Yeah.
I don't claim to be like the best like caller by any means. Like I've never been the guy, you know, Corey Jacobson or, you know, whoever that just really loves that run and gun scenario of boots on the ground, calling, setting up. Like I definitely do that, but I think I've translated like the whitetail hunting, especially the early season, you know, September stuff where you're not getting full blown like rut activity. Mm-hmm. You know, I've translated my whitetail roots to like go sit on meadows and, you know, trails and bedding areas to just sit and wait.
Yeah.
And watch and learn, you know, and put yourself into some of those scenarios and areas where you're going to have a high probability, as opposed to like trying to call and move. Yeah. Like if you're new and inexperienced, like you could be doing more damage than actually helping yourself, you know? So there's that too.
Right. Yeah. Finding that bed to food pattern type of deal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's how I've seen the most success with myself and anybody who's come out to hunt, like some of those cabins with me where they rent the, you know, it's like, you're better off just kind of like sitting and waiting, honestly. Find a good spot, lots of sign, and sit on a meadow or a cut where you can see a little bit, maybe make a stalk in if you got one bedded. But you know, for the average person who's new and doesn't know how to call very well and doesn't know how to move, you know, the right way or you know, move silently and try to sneak in, you're kind of just better off just staying put, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't even know. Can you use trail cameras on public land in Colorado?
Yeah, you can use trail cameras, but they can't be cellular.
Okay.
You can still use just your standard, you know, SD, but they can't transmit wirelessly, you know, so,
okay.
Does even that on private land too.
Okay. You know? So cell cams are a no-no in Colorado.
Yeah. But you still, you know, I know there are other states like Arizona, you know, for example, public land, you can't even use a regular trail camera. You know, they ban those. I think just on public, I think private, you still can. But
yeah. And that seems like a task to get up there, put a trail camera up where these elk are at. Cause I can remember the one time we hiked up to this meadow. It was like 11-2 or something like that. We were real high and you had a trail camera up there and we went and checked it. And, there were some elk on there, but you have to go set it up and then you have to go up there again to check it, which is, it's like a 3-hour journey to go do this. It's not like, hey, I'm going to just drive the truck right up to it. It's impossible.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah.
Does cell cameras or not cell cameras, but trail cameras in general play a role in your annual strategy at all?
I think for me as like a resident, they definitely do. You know, I don't use them too much anymore. Now, if I have like a draw unit, you know, hunt where I've spent 5 years or whatever saving up for, you know, I will do some scouting trips and run some trail cameras, really just to like,
yeah,
kind of learn the land, what's out there. You know, I'm not trying to pinpoint a specific bull or whatever, but I think, you know, I think they do have a place. Again, I think they can hurt you sometimes, you know, because you can be hiking in, you know, checking them and, you know, blowing out certain animals in certain aspects. You got to be smart about that. But for the average person that's just coming out for a week, honestly, I'd probably just leave them at home. You know, that's my strategy. I just put stock in, and elk are different than deer. You know, they're herd animals. They could be 2 miles over here one day and four miles over there the next day, and they're not going to have, you know, necessarily the same patterns, you know, all the time. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you can't put much, you know, stock into it, I guess, you know. And you can kind of get caught up on like, what if you do see a big bull on that trail camera and you're like, man, like, this is the spot, I'm gonna sit here the rest of the week, and then like you might not see anything, you know. It's right. just not it doesn't translate the same as, you know, your typical whitetail,
yeah,
stuff. So
yeah,
I don't use them a lot anymore.
Okay, so winding down this episode now, for someone who is maybe has a tag that they've drawn this year, or they've got an over the counter tag that they've picked up, or maybe in a couple years they're going to pull the trigger, what are some do's and don'ts to prepare yourself or not do before you come out for your first Western hunt?
Again, I would just, you know, whether it's elk or one, you got to have an interest in it. You know, I have buddies that, you know, I've whitetail hunted their whole life, and, you know, they're just never really had an interest in coming west. You know, some people kind of have this thing of like, well, I should do it because, you know, I should just try it once. But
yeah,
if you're not into it, you know, you're probably not going to have fun, and, you know, you're probably not going to enjoy it that much. But if it's something you actually do have an interest in, you know, I would start with, you know, just learning about it, listening to podcasts, can kind of get in a general feel, researching. If you can connect with somebody, you know, maybe you take a trip out to that state, and, you know, I mean, that's how Danny ended up in Colorado. I mean, he came out for a trip, met some locals in town, and they kind of started a friendship, and that's how it kind of led to him buying property and, you know, doing the cabins and you know, ultimately hunting out there. So maybe you take a trip to that state, kind of get ingrained with the local culture a little bit, learn a little bit about the area. Maybe you meet somebody, maybe you don't, but it certainly is an advantage if you do have a contact in a certain state, or maybe somebody who's done it before, who knows, yep, somebody or willing to go with you, you know. So like kind of starting that network, and from there, it's really just kind of a little bit of preparation on, you know, some gear stuff, getting in shape, and ultimately just kind of deciding where you want to go and what you want to hunt, and, you know, determining what experience you want, you know, whether it's just straight public land. Maybe you try an outfitter the first time. You know, I have nothing against outfitting and private land hunts. Like, you know, we all have different means and opportunities and whatever, and suit whatever fits your experience the best. You know, you want that backcountry, remote, rugged, you know, hike and high elevation, you can go get that. If you want to hunt desert, yep, you know, BLM land that's flat, and you can pull a camper up and, you know, hunt from roads, like, you can do that as well. So it's like kind of starting to think about what experience you want.
Right.
You know, not just actually killing and hunting, you know, it's like, it's more than that. You know, you can, live it a bunch of different ways. And, so yeah, that's kind of where I would start, yeah, with certain things.
Yeah. That's a great point, man. And I think that brings us to the end of this conversation, man. I can't wait. I'm going to lean on you a little bit here in the next, you know, handful of months. And I'm going to try to get you back on the show again to talk specifically about elk, and your experiences with elk and the your learning curve with hunting that species. And of course, I'd love to talk to you about the mule deer hunt, that high elevation mule deer hunt that you had success on, because that's always been a dream of mine, is to go up there at like 12,000 feet someday. But I'm knocking on 50, Adam. Yeah. So like I better get my shit together if I want to go do one of those hunts.
But hey, they're going to have flying cars in the next couple of years, so what I heard, or flying bikes or something, you know, maybe AI will, you know,
help me up here. Robo legs.
Right. Drop you off, you know, somewhere and you'll be good to go. I mean, the secret is get 2,000 acres of private land all to yourself.
That's the key. And that's the key.
You know, that's what ultimately you want to try to get.
Okay. I'm going to really make a note of that. Get 2,000 acres of private ground.
Yeah, it's perfect. Pretty simple. It's, you know, when you boil it down to just that, like, it's very simple.
It perfect.
Makes it very easy. No, honestly, like, it is, it's crazy. You know, I've been fortunate enough to, now that I've been out here a number of years, I always dreamt of, like, just having some access to private land.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily hunting the private land. Sometimes it can be the access through that private land to get you back into, you know, national forest or public that someone else would have to go 2-3 miles around and hike up a big bridge or whatever. You know, I can't tell you how much of an advantage that really is. Like, it is night and day difference when you do have some sort of private access or some private land. Like, it really is a whole different world. And I've been very fortunate the last couple of years to have some of that. You know, so I'm kind of spoiled in that sense. I still do the public land stuff, but man, like, when you're just trying to strictly put some meat on the table, like, if you can get some of the private land, man, it is cool. It's a really unique experience. Yep. So
I feel that. Mr. Parr, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. Hopefully I see you again soon. Take care. And thanks again, man.
Yeah, let me know when we want to do another one. I'd be happy to jump on.
It's tax season, and at LifeLock, we know you're tired of numbers. But here's a big one you need to hear. Billions. That's the amount of money and refunds the IRS has flagged for possible identity fraud. Now here's another big number. 100 million. That's how many data points LifeLock monitors every second. If your identity is stolen, we'll fix it guaranteed. One last big number. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast for the threats you can't control. Terms apply.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.